Jordan Peterson is one of our time's most notable political and cultural commentators. The Canadian clinical psychologist, who's a professor at Toronto University, has raised the ire of individuals who, generally speaking, like political correctness. Just how valid are Peterson's psychological perspectives, though? Michael Edelstein is a veteran psychologist himself. He disagrees with Peterson's generally Jungian views, and he explains why. Edelstein's also the author of the book 3-Minute Therapy, which is being re-released this year. I'm your co-host, Joseph Forcato, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Review of Books. Also joining us is my co-host, Paul Gottfried, head of our editorial board, and this is the inaugural episode of Cotto Gottfried. Jordan Peterson is very well known, obviously, for his political commentary, but his views as a psychologist are not as well disseminated, at least not in the United States. I obviously am not a psychologist, but I do know a thing or two about psychology. His sort of following in the footsteps of Jung, to me, is quite interesting. I can't say that I find all of his views to be practical. I'm sure there's a more clinical term for it that I'm unaware of, but he's a very interesting fellow. And I would suppose that if somebody doesn't like his views on psychology, it would have to do with them taking a more biologically oriented approach to how the human psychological framework goes, although I could very much be wrong about that. Michael, since you are the psychologist here, why don't you start off by explaining how you view Peterson's perspective here?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the framework, because I think that makes all the difference in terms of his approach and my approach to clinical psychology and helping people with their emotional problems. And there's a very simple premise that he seems to miss in working with people. And the simple premise, a very powerful one also, is that our emotions don't come from situations themselves. So if I win the lottery and I'm happy, most people would say I'm happy because I won the lottery, and so would Jordan Peterson, based on what I've been reading from his book. But that's not how we work psychologically. The way we work psychologically is it's never situations themselves that get into our gut and turn it up, but rather it's our thinking about those situations, our views, attitudes, beliefs, ideas, thoughts in our head, what we tell ourselves about the situation. For example, isn't it wonderful I won the lottery? This is great. I can now buy a house and take a trip. So it's our thinking. Now, if you see that, then that's a very powerful idea in helping people with emotional problems, because if they're anxious, depressed, angry, guilty, then you help them identify their thinking, which by definition is unreasonable because it's leading to poor results, and then you teach them how to change their thinking. Unfortunately, Jordan Peterson seems to think that it's situations that cause our emotions, not our thinking. And for example, this is a quote from one of his YouTubes. He says, "You go to the party and you're anxious. Why? The party is a monster. The party is judging you." Well, aside from the slight exaggeration there, the party is a monster, the party is judging you, if we were to distill from that what someone thinks when they're anxious at a party, they're thinking, well, people may be judging me negatively, and this shows I'm a loser. So if they're thinking that way, then it's that thinking that causes anxiety. So it's not the activating event, people judging me, that causes C, anxiety, but rather it's B, your belief about it, I must be thought well of, I'm a loser if people are judging me negatively, and that's what causes the anxiety. And because he doesn't see that, then he goes off into some esoteric theories like Jung, who who has been discredited, and few therapists still practice Jungian therapy that deals with archetypes and symbols and the unconscious and those things. And he's sort of missing the elephant in the room, which is people's unreasonable thinking and helping them with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've been listening to this with great interest because although I'm not an admirer of Jordan Peterson, aside from the fact that he stood up to bullies trying to impose on him gender-inclusive language, I was unaware that there was, you know, something else that he had said or written that should be called into question. And I am delighted that that Michael has provided us with this explanation of how his theories about clinical psychology just don't work.
Yeah, I was just going to mention another major problem with his therapy, and that is he says in his book, 12 Rules for Life, that his model for a therapist is listening, conversation, and truth. And that's sort of like saying the model for a French teacher or a math teacher is listening, conversation, and truth. Mm-hmm. Of course, you want to listen, you want to converse, and you want to be true to what you say. But really, if you're going to help a client in an efficient way, you're going to do much more than that. You're going to teach them methods and concepts and tools they could use to identify their irrational thinking, their musts, shoulds, their demands, and teach them how to change that. So it's really an educational model, not a Jungian model, or he also is very positive on Carl Rogers, not a Rogerian model, which is just listening mainly, but an educational model. Teach your clients how to identify the problem thinking and change that, and ultimately teach them to be their own therapist, because once they learn this approach, then they can do it with themselves for the rest of their lives when emotional problems emerge.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that somebody who was recommending Jordan Peterson to me as a great thinker, my publisher, said, you know, he is a Jungian, and that supposedly is enough to prove that he's a great clinical psychologist. I'm actually very positive about Jung, but I don't take him seriously as a clinical psychologist. I think he's interesting because his anthropological insights are often true, but I think whether or not, you know, his theories about archetypes work as a method for dealing with psychological problems, real psychological problems that the clinician faces, I think is an entirely different matter.
Yes, I think that I agree with you, Paul. I think that writers in particular could benefit from Jung because it would help them form characters and motivations and those kinds of things, but certainly not therapists who presumably want to help their clients in a time-sensitive, cost-sensitive manner. And normally the kind of therapy I do, which is broadly called cognitive behavior therapy, is about 8 to 10 sessions, whereas Jungian therapy and Freudian therapy, which is closely related, goes on and on for months and years, and it's a great way for the therapist to fund
their
Mercedes
money.
And their condos and things like that.
Right. Yeah, there was another point that I was going to raise, that the more I learn about Jordan Peterson, the lower my regard for him becomes. I was sort of introduced to this character because of his defense of what I think is, you know, sensible rules for identifying people as males and females, or, you know, using certain generic masculine terms that have served for both genders for 1,000 years. And I thought this was very nice that he is, you know, he's resisted the force of political correctness coming down on his head like a sledgehammer. The problem is that every time I hear him interviewed, I have less and less respect for the guy. And I wrote an article that was published in American Thinker saying that most of what he says in postmodernism doesn't hold any water. He treats postmodernism as the source of cultural political radicalization. It is not that at all. I mean, it's basically literary theory. And we may not agree with the literary theory. I haven't learned very much from reading postmodernist, but I think their effect on political culture and their effect on the political radicalization of Western societies is something which he certainly does not demonstrate. He simply takes it for granted. Obviously, this is some kind of bugaboo or something he deals with in his college at the University of Toronto. He also keeps saying that postmodernism is Marxism, and as an intellectual historian, I know this is not true. Postmodernists are not concerned primarily with socioeconomic criticism, although you find this in someone like Gilles Deleuze or occasionally Michel Foucault. But you know, the most postmodernists they're trying to sort of deconstruct literary texts, you know, and indicate that there's no authoritative meaning that these texts have. I don't particularly like their theory, but I don't see how it could have these awful political consequences.
Yes, I found your article, Paul, on LouRockwell.com.
Right.
With this critique, I found that very informative.
Yeah.
By the way, I would like to say on Jordan Peterson's side, he's not all bad. In fact, in reading his book, have either of you read any of his book, 12 Rules for Life?
No, I haven't.
No, I have not. I just read some of his articles. Yeah.
Well, I've read just about the first chapter. It's a very interesting, absorbing read, and I think he's really brilliant. He borrows from the Bible and Dostoevsky and other scholarly sources. So it's an interesting book if you want to read an interesting book, but if you want to read something that you think is going to be useful for your emotional life, I think it's going to put you on the wrong path.
Or if you plan to become a psychological clinician, you don't want to start with Jordan Peterson.
Exactly. I don't think you want to end with it either.
Right.
By the way, Paul, more in your field, he has this problem with inequality of wealth, and he says it's winner take all in the lobster world, just as it is in human societies. And he thinks this is really awful. He says the same brutal principle of unequal distribution applies outside the financial domain. Indeed, anywhere that creative production is required. And it's my impression, and you could put some meat on these bones, that inequality of wealth comes from inequality of ability, and we're all unequal in our ability. Some people are much more able than others. So in a way, it's a good sign. It shows that the people, the most creative people who help most people most more than others are getting rewarded for their creations, and which gives them an incentive to do more and help more people.
Well, but I think there's also at least implicit in the statement that you read the idea that if we were truly just society, these inequalities would not exist. You know, that in a sense we're reverting to our animal natures, you know, by creating and perpetuating inequality. And I think there is a moral premise there, which is sort of left begging, that it is the duty of somebody, of the government or of somebody, to create equality of wealth, so that we can escape from this this degraded animal existence, which he's obviously criticizing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
What I find interesting about Peterson's political views in relation to his psychological perspective, I don't quite understand, it's an enigma to me, how he arrives at his criticism of gender roles from his psychological premise. I know there has to be some sort of relationship there, but it's beyond me, although probably it's something that I'm looking at but I'm not recognizing. Does anybody have any take on this situation?
Well, you know, I don't think that one has to look at his psychological theories to know why he came out against gender-inclusive language. I mean, it's these people are simply pests. They're bullies. They push you around, as most liberals do, and they try to control your speech. And what they do is they get rid of normal usage, or English usage in other Indo-European languages, and make you speak in some stilted, strange way to fit their arbitrary notion of equality or justice. And he objected to this. I know people who are Marxists who object to this. So I don't think one necessarily has to look at his psychological theories to understand why he became indignant about this arbitrary, use of power to change normal English usage and why he rebelled. I think it's more of a question of character. I think it speaks well of him as a person that he did this, but it doesn't necessarily have to be rooted in his psychological theories.
Yeah, I agree, Paul. I don't really see a direct connection between mm-hmm. the two, and thankfully there may not be because
right.
of psychology. Is so far off. Here's another quote I got from one of his YouTubes. He says, I wonder why aren't people terrified out of their skulls so badly every second of their life they can't even move? Anxiety is no mystery. Brief spells of calm, that's a mystery. Mm-hmm. So he's saying here he doesn't understand anxiety, and he's a clinical psychologist. And or he does understand anxiety, and everyone should be anxious all the time.
Right, right.
But he doesn't understand when people aren't anxious. So that doesn't speak well of someone that you're considering as your therapist.
I think he must have been reading a lot of Dostoevsky.
Yeah, he does quote Dostoevsky
right.
a few times in his book. Right, exactly.
The question of whether or not his popularity will endure, that's something that I don't think there's a clear answer to. I guess I'll share my two cents briefly. I think that every few years somebody comes along among conservatives, somebody semi-intellectual. You remember a few years ago was Glenn Beck. I wouldn't say he was intellectual in any serious sense. Pseudo-intellectual, but people took him seriously as an intellectual. Now it would appear that Peterson is fulfilling this role, though I do think he's far, far, far more serious than Beck ever was or
right.
ever could be. I think because of that, Peterson will endure for longer than Beck has, but I can't see Peterson ultimately changing the cultural state of affairs in Ontario, where he is, or in the United States more broadly, along with Canada. I could just be being pessimistic, but that's the situation as I see it.
Yeah, I find Canada is worse than the United States in terms of the imposition of political correctness.
I think a good role model for Peterson is Camille Paglia. And Camille Paglia shares many of his opinions on against political correctness and gender identity and those kinds of things. And she's brilliant also and has a great understanding of cultural history. And Jordan Peterson seems to also, and the Bible and writers and things like that. But she doesn't venture off into psychology or politics or economics very much. She sticks with her areas of expertise. And I think if Jordan Peterson did that, he might have a lasting impression on people over the long term. But I think he throws in too much to discredit himself.
Yeah, I think you're right. Paglia, though, is a sharp polemicist. From what I've, the YouTubes and interviews with Peterson that I've listened to would not suggest that it is anything like the verbal acuity or the capacity or ability to come up with sharp rejoinders that you find in Paglia. He's sort of almost like a sententious professor who has sort of been cast into a role for which he doesn't seem particularly well suited. This will go on for us. Someone like Tucker Carlson and this, and he appeals to respectable, moderate conservatives, who want to push back a little bit but don't want to get too rude. And yeah, you know, these are my bête noire. I'm always attacking these people. But I think Peterson is the kind of person who would appeal to them. He's, you know, he's very professorial. He reads a lot of literature. He quotes the Bible, quotes Dostoevsky, Jung, and others. He makes a good academic impression, and he did, you know, show some courage in Ontario, and it's still paying the price. They're still trying to kick him out. So, you know, there are things about him that we can admire, and I would think politically he's somewhere to the right of Polya, who is, you know, for gay rights and feminism and so forth, but, you know, is also a very sharp critic of the left. But he, as I said, I don't think he has the verbal abilities or the ability to come up with you know, sharp responses, which I think you know, these things have characterized Polya, and I think make her in some ways a kind of spellbinding speaker.
Yeah. Although he did quite well in that popular interview with that news broadcaster, I think her name was Kathy Newman or something
right,
like that.
Right. Right. He did.
You've seen that? I thought he was very sharp in that.
He was there. Yeah. Less so in the Tucker Carlson hour that I saw a few days ago.
Yeah. Also, in terms of the people he appeals to, it's a bit of a mystery to me that he appeals to the kind of people you characterize, Paul, which I agree with. Yet a lot of his stuff is very literate and super intellectual, and I don't know how they quite understand that.
But they don't. I mean, they simply leave the esoterica, you know, they just put it aside, you know, and they focus on his criticism of the people trying to impose gender-inclusive language on him in Ontario. And also, I think the attacks on postmodernism, because I call Conservatism Incorporated is always coming up with that. I mean, Roger Kimball, the New Criterion, commentary post articles on this. And, you know, as I was in another interview, as I was telling Joseph, that in fact these attacks on postmodernism are, you know, they really don't target anything that I find particularly sinister, but they do provide an enemy. I'm also bothered. Peterson keeps saying that, you know, Marxism has come to Canada in the form of postmodernism. That's simply not true. Most postmodernists, I don't even find to be recognizable Marxists. They're not even that smart. It's not Marxism. I mean, you know, that we're facing. It's totalitarian left, but not in a Marxist form any longer. You know, in a cultural form. You know, it's trying to control our language, what we can read, what we're allowed to say, this is the threat that we're facing. It is not some weird way of reading literary text, which seems to be the gripe that I hear Peterson making all the time.
Another side of Peterson that we haven't touched on yet that I think appeals to people is just his delivery and his speaking. He speaks with a very authoritative manner, as if I am 101% right, and if you don't agree
with
me, you're 101% wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And he speaks very forcefully. And he also has this brooding manner, which may be interpreted as someone who thinks very deeply about things, and I think that appeals to people.
I agree. I've noticed the same things.
It is something that I can't quite figure out. What is his prime constituency? Is it conservatives? Is it progressives? Is it libertarians? To whom does he really appeal? I can see how he would be able to get a good deal of people from both groups. But ultimately, I would think he comes down more on the libertarian than conservative side. But then again, postmodernism, as Paul mentioned to me in a previous discussion, there are some people on the far right who are postmodern, and I guess libertarian could be postmodern. So I don't think that an anti-postmodernist argument is something inherently designed for conservatives or libertarians at all.
No, but I think attacks on postmodernism play well among certain groups that are allied to the conservative movement. For one thing, Catholics, you know, get very excited about this stuff, it's a kind of cultural and moral danger. It is an assault on clear meaning and, you know, a kind of rational world order created by God. So if you pick up Catholic conservative publications like Crisis or First Things, you see, you know, one attack after the other against the evils of postmodernism. Also, people who are teaching in universities, you know, who have some kind of traditionalist inclination, they're always denouncing postmodernism. You know, that this is the source and font of all evil, and they do not accept the clear meaning of text, and we understand this. And then, of course, you do have left-wing postmodernists who argue that, you know, there is an interpretation, a hegemonic interpretation of text being imposed on us by white male property owners or heterosexuals or whatever. So there is a point of intersection, I think, between postmodernism and cultural Marxism and political correctness. But to think that the major, you know, the major evil is postmodernism, I think, takes some imagination.
Do you have anything to add, Michael?
As far as his clinical psychology goes, if you want to learn more about my approach, which is a more modern approach and more therapists are doing it, the person who devised it all is named Albert Ellis, E-L-L-I-S, a genius in the area, and he's written over 80 books, so you can read some of his books, and I wrote a few books, the most well-known of which is 3-Minute Therapy, and I have a website, 3minutetherapy.com, and 3 is spelled out, T-H-R-E-E.
That's all for this week. Thank you for joining us. See you again next Sunday.